Welcome everyone to the Columbus Metropolitan Club Forum of the Week entitled Skepticism in Science. How did we get here, especially coming off the pandemic and all of the hesitancy when it came to the COVID vaccine? We have two great guests to break it all down for you, including former NASA astronaut Dr. Kathy Sullivan and current president and CEO of COSI, Dr. Frederick Bertley. Your host this morning is former journalist and current owner of Scott Light Consulting, Scott Light. And without further ado, let's get you to this great conversation.
So I'm going to start off with a quote from actually a book that Jane read. Kurt Anderson wrote a bestseller called Fantasyland and How America Went Haywire. Let me also say that, yes, he was doing his book tour in 2017 during the Trump administration, but this book was finished during the Obama administration. So we're trying to keep politics kind of to the side here today. This is what Kurt said about the subject that we're discussing today. Quote, "What's happening in our country today, this strange post-truth fake news moment, isn't new, but rather the ultimate expression of our national character and our national path. America was founded by dreamers, magical thinkers, true believers, impresarios, and by hucksters and their suckers. Believe what you want fantasy is deeply embedded in American DNA," end quote. So to our guests, go. No. Dr. Sullivan, why don't you start us off with that?
Oh, no, Frederick's
going to. Okay, okay.
No, that resonates with me. And I think also of a book that I read years ago by Susan Jacoby called The Age of American Unreason. She similarly traces back threads of our DNA that give us this bent. She traces several other ones beyond what he mentioned, though, and a couple that struck me and have stayed with me is think about the English settlers, the European settlers who first came over. Who were they not? They were not from the educated, privileged classes of Europe. They were the people who didn't matter and didn't have standing in Europe, going to this empty land, quote unquote empty land, and carving out a bit of a life for yourself was a way they could craft themselves. And not that many decades later, you know, England is beginning to fade, America is really rising and thriving, and you got to think there was a little bit of a, see, I told you your blankety-blank education didn't count for so much. Our good old common sense and frontier lessons and just do it ourselves, it's the match for any fancy education you got. Look who I am now. And she notes that this has waxed and waned in various cycles through our history, but her book, by the way, came out in 2004, and her concern at time that she issued her book was that this is probably the most dangerous resurgence of this climate, of this mindset, because it is accelerated so much by a divisive political climate, and it was divisive then, more so now, but still then, and the accelerant of social media and mass media. So my wacky ideas can now get out to millions of people and inflame or incite or encourage or arouse them like that, twinkling of an eye. In the olden days, you used to have to travel around to, you know, campaign tents or Chautauqua tents and maybe get 30 or 40, 50, 100 people at a time. So ideas would percolate more slowly. Now they spread like wildfire, good, bad, or otherwise.
Dr. Burley, go ahead and sum up the last 500 years, if you would. Go ahead.
For fair small task, I'll quote another famous writer. Fantasy is what people want. Reality is what people need. And I say this as a practicing scientist who creativity, imagination, dreaming is a critical part of advancing technology, et cetera, and part of the scientific engine. But while it's nice to be fantastic and certainly dream, what we've seen just in the last 24 months, you know, reality is critical. And that's, you know, why science is so important. That's why this conversation is so fun. Science isn't the answer to everything. It's a process to get as close to the truth as you can. And that's what people need. So it's fun to have fantasy, but it's good to have a dose of reality to get you through it.
Where do we go in terms of the building blocks to rebuilding that confidence in science. Where do we start?
Well, I would agree with Frederick. I think, and I would hope, that the experience of the pandemic might have some seeds of beginning to rebuild some of that. It is a fantastic, remarkable effort. The coordination and cohesion among the scientific community, the speed of advances coming out and being communicated, and then very quickly, you know, not languishing in the scientific journals for a decade or so, but very quickly being translated into lab results and prototypes and out into the field to benefit all of us. It is a great example of what science can do. And I would add a little bit to what Frederick said about what science is. I often say to people, scientists and engineers do basically two related but slightly different things. Scientists build answers, important verb, build answers to questions no one's encountered before. They've got a stock of knowledge and a set of tools that they can start building with, but it is a building process. It's not knowing it. In school, you think science is knowing the answer on the test. Science is having the tools to build answers. And we saw how valuable that can be when we have something completely unexpected, never encountered before, hit our whole society. And engineers conceive of and make real things that have only ever been dreams and imaginings before. Spaceships to the moon, submersibles to the bottom of the ocean, you know, bridges across big rivers, whatever it might be. But so it's the building of an idea, a solution to a problem you just encountered. You know, that is the value of it. I think one reason we're in this divide is, for many years, the power of science in this country really affected government, it affected policy, it affected the military. Sort of around the mid-80s is where I would trace to, and that's when conscious decision at national scientific policy funding levels was made to shift more funds away from the Cold War, World War II, physics, weapons stuff into public health and the vitality of the American people. And part of what that brought about was science now having things to say to each and every one of us about our health, how we could live better, how we could live better on the whole planet by reducing carbon emissions or treating the environment better, how we could live better individually by managing our own health better. And, you know, we kind of liked the science stuff when it won us a war and got us to the moon. None of us really much like someone telling us how we ought to live. My suspicion is that's probably been part of triggering this resurgence of antipathy toward science.
Yeah, I mean, amen. to add to that, you know, I think it's a great question. Like, how do we rebuild the trust and confidence in science? And a few things. One, there's a great article, if you get a chance to read it. It's by Gordon Gauchat, G-A-U-C-H-A-T. And he studied the nation's interest in science and trust in science from 1976 to 2010, so about 35 years or so. And what he saw in the 70s and related to, you know, after the Sputnik and the NASA boom, et cetera, this big trust in science. And the group that trusted science the most was a conservative group. And that just waned over time to 2010 to this growing mistrust. And so I think the first thing we need to do when we think about rebuilding the trust is we need to unpack it. It's a classic kind of educational litmus where you don't have one educational tool to teach everybody in a room. Different people learn different ways. In the case of the science distrust community, it's not one community. It's a series of different groups. So, for example, if you're talking about conversations around climate change, that's one group. That's a political hot ball. If you're on one side of the political aisle, you believe climate change is a thing. If you're on the other side, you don't. 99.9% of scientists on the planet, not just in the U.S., are 100% convinced that climate change is a thing. But it's become a political hot ball. Yet, if you look at vaccines, it's a completely different group. It's usually mothers, young mothers, you know, of kids who are kind of 0 to 6 range who are trying to question, I'm giving all these things to my kiddos. Are they dangerous? Are they not? They're most of the time at least have one undergraduate degree, if not an undergraduate degree and a master's. So they're very well educated, but they're questioning, you know, the validity or the safety of vaccines. Then you look at the African-American and Latino population. Completely different reason why they're distrusting science. You got the Tuskegee experiment. You got Henrietta Lacks cells. You got all these atrocities that the medical system has done on underserved populations. So all three of those examples, they don't trust science, but the solution isn't the same for each of them, right? So in the case of African-American and Black and brown community, you got to convince them and show them by way of precedent setting, that there's a different attitude to how you might treat them, and they may be more engaged in science. And as they see more people that look like them being authentic leaders and educators, they start to feel more confident. Whereas the political hop ball, well, that's a politics thing. I won't touch that. And in the case of the vaccine situation, you know, that's something where you can't hit people over the head and say, oh, vaccines are good, vaccines are good. You have to show them the information and let them get access to great information so they can judge themselves. And then to Dr. Sullivan's point, that's hard because this has democratized everybody's opinion. And so now you're searching for information, and how do you get the right information because everything's out there? So it's a great question, but I think the answer lies in understanding the diverse reasons for how people came to mistrust science and then tackling it kind of one group at a time.
I think, too, you know, people, a lot of people wake up and, yes, this is the first thing they grab. And I say, especially in the last 10 to 15 years, instead of people looking at this in the morning and looking for information, a lot of people are looking for confirmation of their opinion, of what they're already thinking. I want to pick up a little bit, Dr. Burtley, on what you were talking about the vaccine and Dr. Sullivan, you mentioned it as well. So how did we get here in that, yes, are there legitimate concerns when you take a vaccine process that normally takes a decade and you shrink it down to a year or 18 months? Absolutely. Are there legitimate questions that need to be asked about that process? But how did we get from there and asking legitimate questions to seriously people going on cable TV and saying that the government is injecting a chip in them with this vaccine? That's what happened to the confidence level, and what happened there to where we got to that?
Well, they all remember that science fiction movie from the 60s where the aliens would abduct people briefly, and you knew if they'd been abducted because there was a little scar in the back of their neck from where the chip was inserted. Anybody remember that movie? They were sort of very robotic after that. Running joke in the astronaut corps, if someone got a management assignment, we'd turn them around and see if they had come back to the office with the chip implanted. Well, Scott, part of it, I think, roots in confirmation bias. If you're already worried generally about life and the vaccine, if you already distrust government, and you know, we're forgetting a very explicit campaign dating back at least to the 80s to posit that the problem in government is not any kind of solution in our world. Government is always a problem. It's been a strong political overtone for 40 years in this country. So you've got a backdrop of you should never trust anything government says or does. And now it's the government approving this. By the way, they hurried, and they're trying to propagandize you to take it. There's three or four elements there that fit right into a conspiracy theory mindset. And then there's, you know, obscurity about some of the dimensions of the speed of this thing. Was approved under an emergency declaration. That has to mean it was hasty. That has to mean it was badly done. An FDA emergency declaration doesn't mean any of that. It doesn't change the process flow of getting an approval at all. What it does is authorize the pharma companies to start large-scale production of a compound before the final conclusion is reached. It's actually the companies taking a significant risk, because if it doesn't pass those final trials, that's all going to be useless stock that they've invested in. But if it does pass the trials, you have thousands or hundreds of thousands of doses ready to go rather than waiting months more to start that up. I have a family member of my own whose principal reason to not want to take the vaccine was it was done under emergency. You know, that's got to mean they've been hurrying and hasting, and somebody pressured the politicians probably to slap that declaration on them, and so I don't know what's in there. And it doesn't mean any of that at all, but that's a presumption that's very widespread.
You studied immunology. Were there times where in this whole debate over the last couple of years where you just wanted to jump through the TV and strangle someone? Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, that's so that's a setup.
But never stop.
So a few things. One, I just want to echo what Dr. Sullivan said. It's important to understand the way the vaccine developed, a few things. They didn't start from scratch. We've had all kinds of SARS viruses, coronaviridae, that have existed for decades. Scientists have been working on these all the time. Fast forward, we get this new strain. It's out there. So it's not like they started from vaccination ground zero. They had a whole bunch of candidates for the last 10 years that they just had to tweak to get ready. But what was really exceptional is what Dr. Sullivan said. When you're coming up with a vaccine, yes, there's a nobility of I want to save lives. This is great. But at the end of the day, you know, you're filing a patent for it and you want to start a company, right? And you want to make money. That's what she talked about. Well, companies have to go through all this funding, venture funding, et cetera, to support production. But they're never going to pump hundreds of millions of dollars behind something until they know it's tested. The U.S. government and other governments around the nation removed that risk. So when you heard about the Operation Warp Speed, that was President Trump and other leaders of other nations pumping not 10 million, not 100, billions of dollars. In the case of the U.S., about $24 billion at day zero. So when Dr. Sullivan talked about, oh, they're testing the vaccine in clinical studies in humans now, they were mass producing that vaccine at that time. So a year later, when they have the data, hey, it's safe or whatnot, and the FDA signs off on it, you don't have to wait another 2 years to produce the vaccine. That's why, if you remember, first it was in the UK with Moderna and then here, or Pfizer and then here, and you saw literally the day it was approved, trucks were rolling off the same day. Like, well, how is that possible? Because they've been producing it already. And that's why it's fast. So no short corners were cut. They didn't you know, change the direction of how to be safe and secure for people. They just had an amazing investment in different national governments to support the mass production so they're available in time. In terms of jumping through the TV to choke people when they – I think this is probably the most important point that scientists need to respect the larger community. And most scientists worth their salt will say this. We love when you ask questions. You should ask questions. Nobody should take something, frankly, and inject in your body or put a chip in your neck without knowing if it's dangerous. So it's absolutely ask the questions, but then go and seek the answers from the professionals. If your sink breaks or toilet breaks, don't call Frederick Burley, call a plumber. If you need electrical work, call an electrician, right? If you need cardiac surgery, go to a cardiac surgeon. If you want to learn about vaccines, no disrespect to talk show hosts or entertainers, unless they are trained in this, don't go to them. I mean, people like to say, oh, I have an opinion about it. Well, if you had an opinion on flight, if one of you had an opinion on flight, pick on you, sir. Would the rest of you get on this plane if he thought he knew how to fly? No, you wouldn't. You'd go to a pilot who's trained in that. And so the jumping through the screen is twofold. One, as scientists, we need to respect people's questions and try to meet them where they're at and address them with some information and try to guide them along. But the second thing, as regular people in the world, which we all are, like, go to experts for your information and don't just get something to talk. But then the last piece I want to say, you know, how do we go from questioning, which I love how you set that up, to now these whack job, you know, magnetism kind of weird shows. That gets back to this, right? 20 and 30 years ago, those whack jobs or those really oddball persons would not have an audience. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't make the filtration of common sense, to use your words. But today, because of this device, you can find an audience anywhere. And because there's no borders, you know, you find hundreds of views, thousands of views, hundreds of thousands of views supporting your idea, and all of a sudden now you pop up and you're on a show. And so that this is, you know, as great as this is, and it's great, it can be a tool that can make things difficult.
What excites you both about the advances that we're making in science, seeing so many young people head into STEM fields? What gets you excited about what you're seeing out there right now?
You know, the youth get me excited, that they are vibrantly interested in this. They are curious about how their world works. They are curious about what tools they can develop intellectually and practically to help them navigate. And even more importantly, so many of them are motivated by trying to want to improve or contribute to the world. Yes, make some money. It's a very fair motive. But there's more. I meet more and more that have a quest for purpose. I need to make some money. Maybe I even want to be very well off. But by virtue of doing something that matters, doing something that adds to the world or that moves my community forward or helps me protect people or helps me save lives, that passion towards purpose that is even a little bit greater than self, that's, I think, what gives me hope that we can reconnect some social fabric, come around to some shared purpose that we all can hold to together, maybe have plenty of arguments about how best to achieve that. But you know, if you can find even that one kernel of trusted common purpose, It's a version of the old hierarchy of loyalties, right? We disagree tremendously about monetary policy or banking policy or environmental permitting, but somewhere down here, we all love living in this community. We love that it's got some greenery. We love that it's got waters you can safely kayak on. We love that our kids can move around the community with a high degree of safety. We all love that. Well, let's keep coming back to that home base and recentering on what are things we can do together to make sure we continue that and sustain that and grow that. So can we find some things like that in the sciences and the technologies that are going to shape our future and grow them and develop them together and bring our youth into being the engines that drive that forward? That's where I find some hope.
What excites you?
Yeah, and it's another and situation. I mean, I'm excited twofold about the promise of prosperity. I mean, the cool thing about science is democratized kind of the access to I can know something and I can work towards a job. I mean, we talk about in this great country, greater than 50% of the jobs right now are STEM-related, science, technology, engineering, and math. And we're not talking about getting a PhD in a given field. We're talking about you can get a two-year community college degree and start at $60,000 or $70,000. That's A. B, because of technologies like this, you can access information, so you can reach more kids, especially the underserved kiddos who might not have access to high-end companies or that, but can start using these devices as a gateway to learn about STEM, which can be objective. It's not did you like this art picture or did you like that poetry? 2 + 2 = 4. And if you can get around learning that, you can move forward. And so the excitement about more people having access to this American dream about having a stable job and stuff, STEM can provide us. Not the only answer, but it's definitely one answer. The second thing, what excites me, and this is why I'm super excited to partner with WOSU, so this is definitely a recognition to the great partnership with that university and that fine station, PBS affiliate, is working on this show called QED with Dr. B. You get to interview these amazing men and women that are changing the very way we live and elevating what can happen with us as humans. I'll give an example. They can now, as you know, you've heard about this CRISPR-Cas9 kind of whole gene modification thing. Well, now we can go in, and for some genetic diseases, we can identify the gene, we can cut out the bad gene, replace in the good gene, and you are healed. I mean, this is unbelievable. Sickle cell, which affects persons of African descent and Jewish populations predominantly, they are being cured literally from this debilitating disease. Parkinson's disease. Imagine you can diagnose somebody with Parkinson's disease just by putting on sensors on their body and watching their gait. Medical doctors, we as humans can't do that, but these algorithms that they write for this AI, this artificial intelligence, can see these micro tremors in your step as a 40-year-old or 50-year-old saying, you know what, 20 years from now, you might have Parkinson's. I mean, these are unbelievable things. When you talk about what excites me, the promise of having a great future that's going to solve climate change, it's going to solve our water issues, it's going to solve famine, it's going to solve all these things, that's, we saw it in this pandemic. It was science that got us out of here. It's getting us out of here. There's no, I don't care your politics. There's no other way we got out of this pandemic except through vaccines, which is a consequence of science. And if we apply that to all these other things that are negatively impacting, it's super exciting to what can happen and the promise.
I'm going to throw one other in that I recalled as Frederick was talking, similar vein to what he was mentioning on the sickle cell. I just learned about this yesterday in the front end of my research, but I learned about it from my physician, not from some guy on YouTube. A new company, new capability. Think of this. So we have diagnostic tests for only a few cancers, right? Breast cancer. We don't have diagnostic tests for some of the most lethal ones, like pancreatic cancer comes to mind. New technique. It's beyond lab trial. It's out in hospitals and in testing and or clinical use now. A couple of vials of blood drawn. Run it through this process. The company's called GRAIL, and the process is called Gallery with an I on the end. And it can detect 50 different cancers for which we currently do not have any diagnostic testing, including pancreatic. And what's important is it can test them when they're, because these are the ones that you know, when you finally know you have it, you're stage 4. Hypermetastasized, short runway left. That's how you know you had it, is you're imminently dying. This technique can detect them in early stage 1 and 2 when they are still treatable. No evident outward symptom. Think about that. Think about the death rates. Think about the young people that are taken out suddenly with pancreatic cancer, bile duct cancer. 50 that we can't currently detect until you're weeks away from dying, we could detect and treat. It's just, that's crazy. And that's science. That's building an answer to and building a technique to a problem that no one's been able to solve before. By data, by knowledge, by testing, by trying, not by opinion, but by proving. 2 + 2 = 4, and that car does or doesn't work, and that plane does or doesn't fly. And if you're trying to stake out a position because I happen to prefer 2 + 2 = 6, go ahead, you'll crash the plane because it's just wrong. It's not a matter of opinion. You're welcome to your opinion, as someone famously said, but not to your own data.
I was looking at some education numbers in terms of the U.S. versus the rest of the world. And certainly education is a multi-tiered undercurrent in this whole discussion. Greece now has a higher graduation rate than the United States. 15-year-olds in many countries across the globe, including Russia and Latvia, are better at math than Americans. On reading proficiency, 1/5 of American 15-year-olds can't read at the level expected of a 10-year-old. I saw a quote from Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. He was reflecting on some of those statistics and others, and he said this: "As I see it, the greatest threat to America's future is less a surging China or a rogue Russia. It's more of our underperformance at home." So if our higher ed is still considered an envy of the world, there is still this big discussion going on with what we do with pre-K through 12. What would you like to see in that scope when it comes to education?
Well, our higher ed is still very highly regarded, but in particular in the STEM and engineering fields, look at the demographics of the students in both the undergraduate and graduate majors, and it is increasingly not U.S. nationals. It's other foreign nationals who know what science and engineering can do to power their country and the livelihoods in their country forward, and they want the best possible training they can get in those fields to take back to their country. And they're coming here because our research enterprise is still very strong and vibrant. It's strong and vibrant for lots of reasons. One is stable public support so you can pursue long-term, high-risk projects that corporate industry won't do. It's also because you can pursue any idea. It's an unfiltered, uncensored scientific inquiry. So that's what's happening. But what about our kids? What about K through 12? Boy, the trends have been there for a long time, Scott. This is not any kind of new trend. When I was on the National Science Board in the early 2000s, we lamented over this over and over. I think it's a couple of things, but let me start with an observation. Every human being, every little infant born in this country is at the moment of their birth a scientist. The scientific method is how infant humans become developed humans. It is test, sense, experiment, make some sense of it, try again. Scientist in the crib is the way we express it. So this mode of inquiry and of scaffolding knowledge together and learning by doing and proving and testing and finding out that it is intrinsically natural to human beings. We manage largely to school it out of kids. Okay, so their naturals added up to about age 5. We put them in school. We sort of humdrum it out of them because school is too focused on control, discipline, quiet, structured things together. Everyone march along together. It's not enough doing of things and experiencing things, even at the early grades. And then come in the age 12 or 13, we start to realize, I don't know if we'll have enough of these kids take a science major. Now we try to reinstall curiosity and inquiry into them. That's nuts, folks. So the kind of experiential learning that places like COSI were founded and designed around building, the kind of experiential learning that the Metro School, which is a COSI-Battelle-Ohio State partnership, now all grades, started as just a 9th grade cohort back when, that kind of experiential learning can transform the situation. Let me give you one anecdote that is my proof point for what I just said. The Metro School began with one cohort of 9th grade students that were going to advance and be filled in behind. They were chosen by lottery from all districts, all 16 districts in Franklin County. So the only thing a family or a student had to do was opt in, put their name in that hopper, and then the number handful were picked out that filled the seats we had. The starting grade point average of that first class was a C+. No one knew what Metro School was. A large proportion of the kids that put their hat in the ring probably did so because they were failing at the school they were at or felt unsafe at the school they were at or socially didn't fit in. But no one had heard of STEM school before. No one had heard of Metro School before. We made that up within the last week or so. So this was a leap of faith, probably driven largely like the immigration of many of our ancestors, because it stinks back here. I'll try something new. This Metro advances students on mastery, not by the calendar. It's not at the end of this semester you will all be at this point mathematically. You're really racing ahead. You're having a little more trouble. But this is the mastery target, and you will each meet it on your own path at your own pace. Makes the parents actually absolutely crazy, by the way, because they always want to know, is my kid where he ought to be at week six? And the answer could only ever be, your kid is where she is at week six. But we will attain mastery. Punchline. Those C-plus students drawn randomly from 16 districts throughout the county, all but one of them placed out of all high school math by the end of their grade 10 year. All but one of them passed the Ohio state-mandated graduation test by the end of their grade 10 year in math, starting with C-plus averages. That's what experiential learning can do. And that let their 11th and 12th grade years be internships at COSI, at Battelle, on campus. It let them take college credits. So when they finished high school, they had, one of them had credits enough to have an associate degree when they finished high school. Others had, you know, half a year's worth of college credit already under their belt, plus the study habits and social bearing to handle themselves on a campus. Think about if we did that and gave that kind of learning to all of our students. Think how fabulous that would be. You wouldn't be pushing kids into STEM.
I mean, Dr. Sullivan just nailed the answer. So, you know, what I'll add to it is the data you're referencing comes from two primary sources. There are two international exams, one called the TIMSS, T-I-M-M-S, and one called PISA, P-I-S-A. And they study the data you talked about. They measure kids in elementary school, middle school, and high school around the world. Around the world over decades. And they spell a lot. So when you hear, oh, American students are 29th in math out of the world or 31 in science, this is based on these two types of tests. The problem is, and one of my favorite quotes is, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Dr. Sullivan explained the problem. What we do in the U.S. is it's an aggregate amount of students taking this test. Well, the lion's share of American kids are in public schools, which are challenged and struggling. A small percentage are in private schools or exceptional public schools like the Metro STEM school you heard here, right? And what happens is, and you can do this, all this data is available online. When you disaggregate the students who go to some of our best public schools and our elite private schools, those students are performing number one, number two on a bad decade, number three in the world. What does that tell you? It tells you that this great country knows exactly how to educate children at the highest level, but the overall public school system hasn't caught up. So it's important to say America is not failing everybody. America is failing, unfortunately, a lion's share of students that are in the challenging public education sector. But there are ample examples of schools right in this nation that are pumping out kiddos going into colleges. And by the way, you began with the colleges and how they're populated. I mean, let's not pretend that we don't have some of the best colleges in the world. And let's not pretend that the science and tech industry in the United States is not number one or minimum number one and number two in the world. I mean, we know how to do it here. We just have to fix the educational system to give all the kids, this is what we talk a lot about at COSI, how do we bridge that educational gap so all kids have a chance at having these kind of experiences?
But loop that back to the thread of this conversation. So we have a cadre, a sizable cadre, pretty sizable, of the kids coming out, the good students coming out and going to STEM fields, best in the world. But we have a general population that comes out of their schooling not well prepared. and not comfortable, not competent, not critically thinking, not seeing that as their skill set. So to this question of discernment of quality of information, careful thinking about the pros and cons of an issue, where did you get those tools, if not through family influences and schoolwork as you grow up? So the large cohort that comes out of our public school system, ill-equipped on those fronts, is more susceptible. We're all susceptible to confirmation bias. We're all susceptible to following the horde. You know, how do you look at reviews on Amazon, right? We all do that at times. But have such a large segment of our population susceptible to that and ill-equipped with any tools that could help counter those influences. That's a problem.
If you see me looking at the clock here, there is a reason, and that is it is our tradition here to have questions from you. So we've got a microphone set up right there, and we're going to get to your questions for our two panelists here in just a little bit. Let me also say, quick aside, I can personally attest to Dr. Sullivan's motivation in that we were at a social gathering together a couple of years ago. My younger son was there. He was in high school then, and he wanted to study physics and math. Don't ask me where he got his brain. I just have no idea. And so Kathy said, well, I want to talk to him. And I was like, are you kidding? I will introduce you to him. He's now entering his second year down at the University of Cincinnati studying astrophysics. I still don't know what that is. I can spell it, and when he comes home or when we talk to him, I'm just going, uh-huh, oh, that's great. Oh, you're learning a lot. Way to get him. You know, go get him, kiddo. So thank you for that, Dr. Sullivan. My last question of the day is this. If you had, and it can be germane to this conversation, or we can open it up because both of you have so many passions and causes that you're involved in. But if you had the American audience right there, 331 million people, and you said, come with me, come join your fellow American in this one cause together, in this one effort together. What would that be? Dr. Bertley, would you start us off? What would that be? Come with me in this one thing.
Well, it's not going to be one thing. It's going to be a conflated series of things. Come with me with an open mind. That's the first thing I'll offer up. And then something my dad taught all of us. I'm the last of four kids, and my dad, just a great guy, he used to tell us, and I didn't understand as a kid, but I totally understand it now as an adult. He would say, son, or to all of us, you know, children, think it's not illegal yet. And so it's this combination of what Kathy said, which is you want critical thinkers. I don't care if you disagree with me. Some facts are facts, other things are opinions. I don't care if you disagree with me, but come with a critical, open mind to listen, hopefully learn, question, seek solutions, but, you know, be a thinker. Don't be sheep, as was referenced earlier. Be a thinker. It doesn't mean that you have to be a radical left or right person, but just be comfortable teasing things apart, challenging things. And so be open and challenged. That'd be my...
Love it.
And if it's 330 million people and each one of you give me a dollar, that'd go well.
I was wondering what my price point was going to be. I think I'm where I want to go is very much related to what Frederick just said. Because you asked about what cause would I ask people to join me in. I would say, come with me. We're going to make school the most glorious learning place you've ever imagined. We're going to transform how we do training and development of our children so that they're racing to school because it's the cool, fun place where they get to think, they get to try, they get to do. And again, that's not to say... there can be a version of this, which is I tried something and it doesn't actually work, but since I tried it, it's valid, you know, that every participant gets a medal kind of thing. Those two don't have to go together. You can have that participation and personal effort and still hold to a target, hold to an achievement level that we will reach together, but we can do it in such a radically better way. And this is not about I need everybody in this room to go be science majors. This is just about the mental tools we should all have to be effective citizens in this 21st century economy on this highly interlinked, interdependent little planet of ours. It's tools that can help all of us live better lives and build better communities in whatever walk of life we choose.
Questions from the audience. Jane Scott.
Yes, there are lots of questions that I have from online, and we'll do every other one for folks in the audience. So let me get started. Talk a little bit about those who have a motivation for spreading misinformation on purpose.
You know, there are lots of motivations, I'm sure. I have a hard time understanding them very well myself. But, you know, there are people who want spotlight, who want to develop a body of followers and some fame, maybe just craving that from an ego point of view, maybe wanting to parlay that into monetary gain, maybe just trying to, you know, moot. You know, I don't actually have a good argument against some policy. So I'm just going to spread disinformation, misinformation. I don't need to win you over. I just need to make you doubt or fear this other one. You know, it's the political version of trash talking in sports. There's two ways to win a sporting competition. One is to actually outperform the other athlete. The other one is to mess with their mind so that they undo themselves and they underperform. That makes your victory easier.
And I'll just add, you know, it's really interesting. One of the cool things about science, it tells you, you know, what's the source of your information, right? You challenge it. And so people who want to spread disinformation or what have you, what's their motivation, right? And once you understand their motivation, then that helps you navigate how you want to process the information you're getting from them. But really trying to figure out what's their angle, where they're coming from. Because 2 plus 2 still is equal to 4. But, you know, if they're saying it 2 plus 2 is equal to 6, what's their motivation for saying that? What's, you know, that helps you navigate through some of the disinformation and get closer to the truth as possible.
Scott Whitlock, a member of Metropolitan Club, thank you both for being here today. And thanks to our moderator for asking wonderful questions. My question is, assuming that skepticism about science and scientists has been increasing, to deal with it, I believe we need to understand the root cause. What do you see as the root cause or causes of increasing skepticism?
Well, it is my own view that one of the root causes is a set of political motivations being amplified and channeled through mass media and social media. It is that, you know, prevail over an argument that you can't really defeat in a substantive way, by distracting, disinteresting, or confusing people. Interesting book that goes into this pretty exhaustively is called Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes. She traces very common trends in money and politics through the campaign of the tobacco industry to divert attention from secondhand smoke, climate change, and several other similar issues. So I don't want policy going in the direction it's going, and I don't really have a good reason why. But I can just make you doubt whether enough is known to warrant proceeding as the scientists are saying.
Do you see scientists as having any responsibility for the root causes?
Yes, please. Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest problems to how we got it, not the problem, but one of the biggest problems is this elitism that scientists often have. They sit in these hallowed halls of ivory tower. They speak in a vocabulary that 7 other people around the world understand, and they think that means they're smarter, and they're disconnected often. And so scientists have an active role, and that's, again, back to QED or other cool shows like that. Scientists have to come out of their shell, make themselves accessible, not trying to alienate the non-scientist. It's not about dumbing down, but it's about meeting people where they are and engaging them and not having them feel like, oh, you hear it all the time. Oh, I'm not smart. You hear that from grown people. And it's scientists are the ones that helped create that myth. Now, I know sometimes part of scientists, they're introverts and they can be labeled as weird or they just want to work in a lab. That's a cop-out excuse. It doesn't mean you have to be the biggest orator on the stage, but you need to do your part to make people feel that this stuff is accessible. So I think that's so important.
Kathy Fox has a question. Are there other countries with different approaches to sharing scientific information with the public that we in the U.S. can learn from?
There are some great examples around. I'm thinking of one in particular that originated in Holland. It's been used in other countries where there's a – particularly where there's a question around some new technology or some new technological development coming into a community. And the approach there is to actually host – carefully chosen word – community conversations. So scientists and citizens get to, and the technologists and politicians get together and talk about what the proposed change is. That method asks some things also of citizens. It's not just come and bandy your opinions about, but it's come and together in mixed groups of politicians and citizens and scientists agree on a question that is important to some of the group and go do some research on that question. Go study it, bring research back. And so you build an answer together. You build an insight together to this proposed development. And based on the process as it goes forward, often it comes to a consensus judgment about proceeding or not. But everyone has participated. It's not just the politicians or the scientists describing what they're going to do and inviting you to say yes or no and then doing it anyway. It's actually bringing you into the process as a participant. It takes what Frederick has been saying. It requires what Frederick has been saying, that you all meet together as peer-level interested parties in this discussion. You have maybe the political expertise. You have the science expertise. You just have the strong interests of a member of the community. That all has to be comparably respected. And then you build an answer together.
I love that. To add to that, you know, as much as I definitely put some of the blame on scientists themselves, ourselves, and not doing what we should be doing, media and just general popular kind of mechanics plays a massive role in this, right? Look what happens in this country. If you can dribble a piece of leather up and down the basketball court, you can make tens of millions of dollars. And by the way, I love basketball. I love sports. If you're a great singer or dancer, you can make tens of millions of dollars. You're a famous superstar. We don't celebrate the men and women who are saving our lives by developing all these incredible tech. I mean, imagine you didn't have the cell phone. Does anybody know who invented the cell phone? Bet you can't name them, but I bet you can name who won an Emmy or a Grammy last year, right? We don't celebrate the men and women that are sacrificing a lot of time to come up with really cool things that are advancing the human condition. That's point number one. Point number two, we don't celebrate teachers nearly enough, right? When I was doing my postdoc at this school up north, there was one of the postdoctoral fellows was from India, and we'd have all these discussions like this. You know, how come kids in India are crushing it in math and science? What's going on there? And she said, you know, in India, we call the teacher, the student, and the room school. Didn't talk about technology. Didn't talk about fancy dorms. Does that? It was a reverence for the teacher and education in general, such a high level of respect, and that translates into kid respecting it, and science at the top of the food chain in terms of that. And so we got a lot of work to do there. I think we can get there, but I think those are two things I'd mentioned on that point.
The other point about media, by the way, this is not hop on Scott moment, but you know, there is such a common lens. I was working, I was helping ABC Media cover, ABC TV cover the first space shuttle launch way back when. And that was the moment where a gentleman named Rune Arledge, who remembers the name Rune Arledge? Wide world of sports, right? Thrill of victory, agony of defeat. He had just taken over ABC News. And that construct, every story is a thrill of victory, agony of defeat story. Every piece of news has a someone won, someone lost. That helps create this distance of the general citizen to science. Science says this, someone says not. And if you never know scientists, if they're never celebrated, your life is personal. Science is this impersonal, anonymous thing that's being done to you. A huge barrier to engaging with it or accepting results that come from it.
I think there's also, we have a shining example in my mind talking about other countries and what we've learned. Look at the example we have in Marysville, Ohio. because Honda and Japan came over here in the 70s and they trusted Ohioans to implement their template, but it took ingenuity and engineering and design work from Ohioans who have now fueled something for 40-plus decades. And granted, they took it, you know, the Hondas and the Toyotas of the world took advantage when Detroit was down in the 70s and 80s, but that's just what happened. But again, I think that's a shining example of, again, the shared concepts internationally. Two more questions. Yes.
Hi, I'm Dara Pizzuti. I'm with The Matrix. And first, I'd have to say, as a mother of school-age children, I feel very lucky that we have two such strong ambassadors to science. So thank you for today. My question centers a little bit on what you guys were just talking about, and that is, it seems to be that we're in somewhat of a perfect storm where there is a mistrust of the media, not just the scientific community, and also this explosion in social media where I think they say a lie can circle the earth five times before the truth has a chance to come up for air. And I'm just wondering, how do you, I mean, that must be very frustrating for the scientific community. So how do you balance our freedom of speech with the need for accurate and truthful information, particularly when the misinformation can hurt your community?
Yeah, thorny question that I confess I don't have a very good answer to, but I would just, the analogy I keep going back to trying to tease it apart and come up with something more intelligent than what I'm about to say is, you know, we're all pretty clear that our freedom of speech is, you know, as unfettered in this country as it is anywhere on the planet. But freedom, liberty to speak, does not give you license to do damage. So there's a limit of yelling fire in a crowded theater and starting a stampede that imperils other people's lives.
That's going to wrap up this week's CMC Forum entitled Skepticism in Science. We hope you'll join us next week at this same time for another great conversation right here on WCBE.
In WCBE's podcast experience, Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future, talks with Greg Moran about the new role of leadership in a hybrid workplace. Double Take reflects on the greatness of the 1988 film Midnight Run. The Internet Says It's True explores a couple common gambling fallacies. And Music Journeys brings back an episode with former Eagles guitarist Don Felder, who headlines the Lancaster Festival July 31st. Hear those shows and more locally produced content in the podcast experience at WCBE.org.